here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Catch me at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight at cambridge105.fm. Those are email addresses, as you recognised. Catch our archived shows at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. That's a website, you know. Or on SoundCloud, and there you just look up Evening Under Lamplight. And of course, you are invited to attend. This Evening Under Lamplight, we continue following Dante's journey through the Inferno. Or actually, this week, we watch his first steps into that infernal world. We're looking at Canto 3, which we'll consider in three parts: the Gate of Hell, the Vestibule, and the crossing of the river Acheron. Last time, you'll recall, we left Dante and Virgil just about to set off on the journey for a second time. After his first consenting to set off, Dante's fear overcame him and he refused the calling. But after Virgil explained that this journey had the divine sanction from three heavenly bodies, including Dante's beloved Beatrice, then the poet changed his mind once more and consented to set off on this terrible path. Canto 3 begins abruptly. Per me si va nella città dolente, per me si va nell'interno dolore, per me si va tra la perduta gente. Through me the way to the city of woe, through me the way to eternal pain, through me the way among the lost. Justice moved my maker on high. Divine power made me. Wisdom supreme and primal love. Before me nothing was but things eternal, and I endure eternally. Abandon all hope, you who enter here. Per me, through me. Well, who is this me? Well, these are the words Dante sees inscribed on the archway over the entrance to hell. All things in this world have their stories to tell, even these gates into hell. Let's look at one or two things this inscription tells us. First of all, hell is described as la città dolente, the city of woe, or the doleful city. It's a city, a concept usually left out of most other myths of hell. Being a city, it therefore, Dante assumes, has some kind of order, some kind of organization, some way of bringing together its inhabitants in a way that makes some sense. The city is for Dante the great image of human society. Heaven is the city of God, where everyone works together in loving and cheerful helpfulness and service and respect and dancing. Hell, however, is a corruption of what a city should be. Here, no one helps anyone else. Each inhabitant is caught up in his or her own painful self, acknowledging others only to curse them or injure them in spite or anger. It's this self-absorption that makes this place, as the gate tells us, a doleful city. It's always doleful or sorrowful to be centered just on oneself. The pain is not inflicted from the outside. It is there on the inside, by the very nature of being an inhabitant in this corrupted city. And yet there is an order to this city, and a very complex order, as we'll discover. It can be mapped out, and there is a logical progression as one moves further into the place. It may be a bit puzzling to read that justice moved God to create this place. Why is that? Well, according to the medieval Catholic mythology, back before earthly time began, when only the eternal angels were around, a group of angels rebelled against the divine order, led by Lucifer, the greatest of the angels, and now transformed into the hideous Satan. And as soon as this evil sprang up, divine justice had to find a place for these creatures. Justice is the impulse to sort things into their proper or just place. And so there must be a place even for these ruined angels. See what I mean? Now, when human beings were created, and then they were corrupted into evil, they too justly found their place in this doleful city. So that's why justice lies behind the whole thing. Now, in the myth, this is the place where disobedience is given its just punishment. On a psychological or even poetic level, though, it's not so much punishment, but the true nature of this self-centeredness that causes the eterno dolore, the never-ending pain. And it seems that we are locked into this painful self-centeredness. Indeed, there's no way out of a self-centered life except for the path Dante is taking, journeying deep into our own underworld, into our own deep selves, and becoming conscious of all the unloving, self-obsessed thoughts, words, and deeds we have indulged in. Only once we become aware of these things can we turn ourselves around. Only in this way is there hope for those who enter in, like Dante, while still alive, while still psychologically flexible enough to change. The Catholic doctrine taught that up until the moment of death, each of us has the free will to choose good or evil. If we die with an evil or self-centered mind or heart, then we go to hell. It's as simple as that. If we repent, even in this split second before we die, then we are saved and we go to heaven, though first we pass through purgatory to clean ourselves. After death, there are no more choices. We are set in the way that we chose in life. That's the doctrine. The poetry, however, is not so literal. The afterlife is not a literal depiction of what happens to our souls after our bodies die, but a kind of theatrical event with a wide variety of characters dramatizing the various conditions of the soul. There's no possibility of change for these characters. They are playing set roles. They are, in fact, only two-dimensional characters, representations of specific conditions, not rounded human beings. Therefore, there's no hope for these characters stuck in their own roles. Abandon all hope, you characters who feature in this poem. But for Dante and for us, living beings, watching this theatrical event, there is every possibility of change. In fact, that's why we've been invited to this theater, so we can see externalized representations of our own inner selves, and recognizing what is wrong in us, can choose to reform and be transformed. Or let's have a Dylan version of this.
You have a resentment, you know that ain't too much of a thrill. You wish for contentment, but you got an emptiness that can't be filled. You had enough of hatred, your bones bonds are breaking, can't find nothing secret.
Twinkling of an eye, you shall be changed. That is, if you enter on your hellish journey while still alive. You drink bitter water and you've been eating the bread of sorrow. You can't live for today when all you're ever thinking of is tomorrow. The path you've endured has been rough. When you've decided that you've had enough, then you shall be changed. Bob Dylan, Ye Shall Be Changed, from the first bootleg triple album. It's interesting that he brings in the idea that you can't live for today when all you're ever thinking of is tomorrow. In some ways, he's hit on the essence of the issue we've been looking at. The opposite of what I've been calling self-centeredness might be called living for today, or living in the moment, mindfully present. The present is the only reality, after all. All these souls in hell, as we'll discover, have rejected the present moment, that is, reality, in favor of some version of unreality. All they're ever thinking of is tomorrow, as Dylan says, or they are erecting barriers to ward off the moment. This is why Virgil characterizes them as le genti dolorose, ch'hanno perduto il ben dell'intelletto, the sorrowful people who have lost the good of the intellect. The good of the intellect is the ability to see clearly what lies before us at the moment. We today call it mindfulness, or what the Buddhists call the Eightfold Path, eight aspects of right living. Now, on the mythic level, we're at the stage of the threshold, the gateway through which the hero enters into his journey. And at the gate, the hero usually finds some kind of guardian, a figure or object that attempts to challenge him as he attempts to cross the threshold. This is to test the hero's mettle. Is the hero really committed to the journey? Those words on the archway into hell serve as the guardian of the gate in this myth. For the damned souls passing through, the words are just a statement of the misery they have signed up for. But in Dante's case, they are the test of his courage. And Dante is daunted. He turns to Virgil and says that these are hard words indeed. As in the previous canto, Dante seems ready to back out. But again, Virgil consoles him. Here you must banish all distrust, he tells Dante. Here must all cowardice be slain. And in one of those moments of tenderness between Virgil and Dante, Virgil puts his hand on Dante's and gives him a reassuring look. Ondio mi conforte, so that I felt comforted. That is, comfort in its root sense of strengthened. Joseph Campbell, whose mission was to open up all myths for us, tells us that once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. I've always liked this phrase to describe the unreal reality of the mythic journey. A dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. Or, more often, a nightmare landscape, at least on this part of the journey. And that's what Dante meets here, as he and Virgil enter Lyra Sansa Stelle, the starless air, no stars, no heavenly light now. Sighs, loud wailing, lamentation resounded through the starless air. And here he gets the audio version of the City of Woe, all rising up to Dante and so affecting that Dante too begins to weep. And that's significant. What has happened is that Dante, weeping like those genti dolorose he hears, has now become symbolically identified with them. They are both engaged in the same activity, which is a poetic way of telling us that they are connected. And this, of course, is the point of the journey, to attend to these characters and see how far we actually identify ourselves in them. So, for a wee break now, let's see how far we can identify ourselves with these wailers in this bit of Poetry in Motion by Amiri Baraka, which certainly enacts in its imagery and music Campbell's dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms.
It's called Wailers for two gone culture workers, Larry Neal and Bob Marley. Wailers. Whalers are we? We are whalers. Don't get scared. Nothing happening but out and way out. Nothing happening but the positive, unless you the negative. Whalers, we whalers, yeah, whale, yeah, whalers. We whale, we whale. We could dig Melville on his ship, confronting the huge white mad beast, speeding death across the sea to we. But we whalers, we can kill whales. We could get on top of a whale and wail. Whalers, undersea defense hot folk. Blues babies humming when we arrive. Boogie ladies strumming our black violet souls. Rag daddies come from the land of never say die. Reggae workers bringing the funk to the people of I. We whalers, all right. Hail to you, Bob Man. We will ask your question all our lives. Could you be love? I and I understand. We see the world. Eyes and eyes say yes to transformation. Whalers, I, whalers. Subterranean night color magis working inside the soul of the world. Whalers, eyes seeing the world's being. Hey Bob, whale on, rock on, y'all come into us as real vision in action. Hey Larry, whale on with Lester and the pork pie, whaling us energy for truth. We whalers is all, and on past that to say, wailing for all we worth. Rhythm folks obsessed with stroking what is with our sound purchase. Call me Theolonius in my crowded whale vessel. I hold the keys to the funk kingdom. Lie on me if you want to. Tell folks it's yours. But for real whaling, not tale telling, the sensitive know who the whalers be. Be we whalers, blue blowers, the real rhythm kings. We sing philosophy, hambone precise findings, image masters of the syncopated. Whalers and drummers, whalers and trumpet stars, whalers and box cookers, whalers and sax flyers, whalers and bass thumpers. Whalers and, hey, whale, we whalers. Trombone benders, magic singers, Ellingtonians, the only trains faster than rocket ships. Shit, cut a rocket in our pocket and put a cord on the wall of the wind. Whalers, can you dig whaling? Call me Bud Powell. You wanna imitate this? Listen. My calling card. The dialectic of silence. The sound approach. Life one day will be filled even further with new numbers we song. But primitive place now, we wailing, be kept underground. But keep it in mind. Call me something dukish, something sassy. Call me by my real name. When the world change, we wailing be in it. Help make it for real time. Call me, I call you, we call we. Say, hey whalers, hey whalers, hey whalers, whale on.
Well, that's whaling in a different way. Eyes and eyes say yes to transformation. Subterranean night-colored magi's working inside the soul of the world. Amira Baraka with the words and the voice. I couldn't find out who it was on the drums and sax, though. But now back to hell, folks, as we move on to the second episode in Canto 3, The Vestibule, or Antechamber of Hell. I spoke about this episode in February, that was Lamplight episode 132, in connection with Walt Whitman's line about preferring those who are wicked rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear. Because we come now to those souls who made no choice between virtuous or wicked, but simply reacted out of conformity or fear. No intellect here, just mindless movement. People who, as Virgil says, lived without disgrace, yet without praise. And that's what Dante finds here, mindless movement. A huge crowd of souls, wailing in agony, running at a furious pace behind banners, running naked, pursued by stinging flies and wasps, their faces streaming with blood from the stings, and the blood, as it pours down, mingles with the tears and falls at their feet, where, as Mark Musa translates it, where disgusting maggots collected in the pus. Well, how's that for our first description of the inhabitants of hell? Nicely vivid, isn't it? But wait, these are not inhabitants of hell. We're not really in hell yet, just the vestibule. These souls cannot be condemned to hell. They are, in a sense, too despicable for hell. Technically, they did not sin. They did not choose to turn from the truth. They can't even be self-centered, since they've given up having any selves to center upon. And in Dante's mind, this makes them even more despicable than those who actually sinned. They obviously cannot go to heaven, since they did not choose the truth, but, and here's the interesting point, they cannot be placed in hell either, since if the wicked souls saw them, the wicked souls would feel superior and look down on these coward souls who didn't even dare to live a full life. And we can't have these damned souls feeling superior to anyone else. So these pusillanimi, or puny souls, have their own spot, a nowhere spot. Virgil tells Dante not to bother spending any time talking to any of these. They're not worth it. Just take a look and move on. Dante is amazed at how many souls are here. More souls right here than Dante thought had ever died throughout all history. I should never have thought that death could ever have unmade so many. He says he recognizes some of these souls, but he mentions none of them by name. They've passed out of everyone's memory, and as Virgil had said, they're not even worth mentioning. Non rationem, Virgil puts it. Let's not discuss this any further. Usually, this category of pusillanimi refers to those who never took sides, who never committed themselves to anything, which is why here in the afterlife they partake in a mockery of taking sides behind empty flags. They are the couch potatoes, the kind of people we today tell to get a life. And Dante implies that this category includes, alas, most people throughout history, completely wasted lives. And as I suggested on the earlier show, also in this category are those who Whitman says are virtuous out of conformity or fear. Afraid of venturing on their own perpetual journey, they take refuge in conforming to the external laws and to the social mores. They aren't virtuous for its own sake, but only to follow the safe way. So we can see what Whitman meant when he declared that it's better to choose wickedness than to be afraid to choose anything at all. Wicked rather than virtuous out of conformity or fear. Better to be in hell than to conform with the crowd all running wildly after some meaningless flag. Often critics speak of the way the dead souls in the inferno suffer contrapasso, enacting in death what they did not do in life. Thus, these pusillanimi, who just sat around all their life, now have to rush about with stinging insects to make sure they keep moving. But there's another aspect to this episode. These details do not show the opposite of what these souls did in life. They describe quite accurately, on a metaphorical level, exactly what they did do. These pusillanimi did not sit still. They were always moving round, always stung into meaningless action. Think about it. When we make clear choices about what we do, we're more likely then to be engaged in what we're doing. But when we do not make active choices in our daily lives, we're not engaged with what's going on, and this engagement makes us bored and restless, and we crave something to appease that hunger of imagination. We crave novelty, instant gratification. We invite the stinging flies and wasps. At least they'll make us feel like we're alive. Our culture, of course, has specialized in pandering to this craving with all sorts of instant gratification, which are represented metaphorically by the stinging flies and the wasps. Wait a minute. My phone just made a noise. I have to check this text that just came in. Sting, sting. Oh, I haven't looked at Facebook for 5 minutes. Maybe someone's put up a new picture. Sting, sting. Just one more game of solitaire. No, just one more, and then I'll stop. Okay, just this one more game, and I'll stop. Sting, sting, sting. Or watch people with a remote control clicking their way deeper into boredom. Dante's great poem reaches right into our 21st century world. And the flags they're all following? These puny souls cannot choose what they want, so they follow brand names. Do you want examples? How many people actually choose which smartphone they want, as opposed to buying the one with the most attractive flag? Or clothes, or whatever? Look, you and I, of course, bright, sensible folk that we are, we always make rational choices, right? Even if sometimes we choose wrong. But you know all those other people. You know what they're like. They just follow the flag of the brand names. And so let's move to Randy Newman's Follow the Flag, which I played on that previous episode, but we can listen to it again, surely.
Stand alone or with somebody else, or stand with all of us together. If you can believe in something bigger than yourself, you can follow the flag forever. They say it's just a dream, some dreamer's dream, that it's an empty thing that really has no meaning. They say it's all a lie, but it's not a lie. I'm going to follow the flag till I die. Into every life little rain must fall, but it's not gonna rain fail. You can rise above, you can rise above it all. We will follow the flag together. We will follow the flag.
You can stand alone, Randy Newman says, or with somebody else, or stand with all of us together. Well, a few of us stand alone, and others stand in couples, but the majority stand all together and just follow the flag. That feels safe, and it doesn't require us to use the good of our intellect, so it's easy. But along with the flag come the stinging insects and the blood and tears at our feet that the maggots are feeding on. That image haunts Randy Newman's song, even if he may not be quite aware of it. At least for us, it haunts the song, and we're richer for that. It all helps us to be mindful of the state of our soul. Catch yourself the next time you're stung by the desire for instant gratification or by the call of some brand name flag to make your decisions for you. Notice what form the stinging insects are taking at that moment in your life. And notice, too, of course, that you are listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're attending this week to Canto 3 of Dante's Inferno. And now we come to the third episode in Canto 3. Dante looks away from these rushing crowds and sees, further on, another crowd, not as large. They're standing by the shore of a wide river, impatient to get across. What makes them so impatient? Dante asks Virgil. You'll know in due time, Virgil answers, and Dante hangs his head in shame. Did he say something wrong? I think Virgil wants him to realize that he was looking too far ahead rather than living in the moment. Don't anticipate. You'll find out when you get there. Dante and Virgil come to the shore and join the others waiting there, and suddenly a boat comes towards them, a kind of punt, with an old man propelling it with a long oar. This, it turns out, is Charon, the ferryman who conveys the souls of the dead across the river Acheron. The medieval Catholic myth has now merged with the Greek and Roman myths, most specifically the myth version of the underworld found in Virgil himself in his poem The Aeneid. Now, there are nice old men and nasty old men, and Charon's one of the latter. He greets the condemned souls with what seems gratuitous taunts. Woe unto you, you wicked souls! Give up all hope of ever seeing heaven. I come to take you to the other shore, into eternal darkness, into heat and chill. And then he suddenly notices Dante there, an anima viva, a living soul. Get lost, he tells him. Move away from those who are dead here. But Dante does not move, and Charon realizes that Dante is a soul under the protection of divine grace, and yells at him that he has to be conveyed to a different shore by a lighter boat. He's referring to the boat that carries the saved souls to the island mountain of Purgatory, piloted by a bright angel skimming lightly over the water. Here, Dante the poet is giving us a preview of the opening of the second of the three big books, Purgatory. He's also making sure we remember that he is not one of the damned, but, by this very journey, a transformed soul. But Dante still doesn't go away, and Virgil speaks up, declaring that the divine will desires Dante to take this route through hell. And what can Charon do but shut up and sullenly go about his business with flaming eyes? So much for Dante, but what about the other souls about to board the boat? Naked and desolate, they shiver in fright at Charon's words, and in an action we will all recognize, even if it makes us blush. As soon as they realize they are stuck in this dreadful place, they start blaming everyone else. It's all their fault. Here's the first sign that they've lost il ben dell'intelletto. They can't recognize the true state of affairs. It was, of course, their own choice that got them there. They blasphemed God, their parents, the human race, the place, the time, the seed of their begetting and their birth. And then the brutality starts, a brutality that cannot help reminding us of Auschwitz, and the way the Nazis herded their prisoners and pushed them along with blows and curses. Charon shoves them into the boat and smacks anyone who doesn't move fast enough with a blow from his heavy oar. But Dante is always startling, and after this brutal image, he shifts to an image of autumnal tranquility, taking us back from hell to the world we know here. In fact, he picks up the image from the Aeneid, but where Virgil had given 1.5 lines, Dante expands it to 6 lines, with an extended simile. just as the autumn leaves fall one by one from a tree, until the bough sees all its spoil upon the ground. So these souls dropped from the shore into the boat, leaving no one on the shore. And they moved onto the boat immediately, like a falcon called back by the falconer. And they crossed the river. But before they reached the other side, there's already a new crowd waiting on the river bank to be ferried across. There's a sad autumnal melancholy here, isn't there? But there's something else going on. Remember that Dante had first noticed their impatience, to get going. And here, too, they show their eagerness. Why? Virgil explains that, in fact, it's la divina justitia, divine justice, that prompts them on. It's justice. Their fear has turned to desire. They have chosen hell through their choices while alive. They are anxious to move on to the place where they belong, painful and hopeless though it is. They still have some inner sense of justice, of what is right. They know what's right, even if, or even as, they set their lives against it. Or to put it another way, in hell there's a place for each aspect of our self-centeredness, and when we are enthralled to that self-centeredness, we want nothing more than to be allowed to go to the place where we can continue to act out what we have ourselves chosen. That was Robert Johnson's Hellhound on My Trail, blues being a fitting tone for this moment in hell, as is the hellhound impelling this singer, and the final image. I can tell the wind is rising, the leaves trembling on the tree, trembling on the tree. I can tell the wind is rising, leaves trembling on the tree. All I need is my little sweet woman and to keep me company. I suppose that sweet woman he lacks is Beatrice, who came with the divine grace that removed the hellhound from Dante's trail. Well, now Dante and Virgil are across the river, encountering the next item on this dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. Attend to how mixed everything has become. The ground is lagrimosa, weeping. Weeping? Mixing the solid earth with watery tears? Almost as if the ground itself is alive and not dead matter? And then up springs a wind which flashes with a vermilion or reddish light, mixing wind, something we feel, with colored light, something we see. This is synesthesia, dreamlike, fluid, ambiguous. And it's not clear whether it's the wind or the vermilion flash of light, but something overpowers Dante at this point, and he faints, dropping down, as he puts it, like someone caught up in a sleep. We might see this fainting as a weakness in Dante, even as we also recognize it as a good poetic device for transition from the vestibule to the next part of hell. But the fainting is also a classic mythic moment. The hero must become vulnerable, must be overcome, and that's why the landscape is dreamlike, fluid, ambiguous, so the hero cannot get a grip on it. The ego wants to understand so it can be in control. Dante has to move beyond his ego, and one step is this dropping as if into sleep. But it's not a sleep, not like in the dark wood at the beginning. It's more like a surrendering of his conscious self to whatever it is that he'll be led to next. And it works through a kind of paradox. As soon as Dante sees the light, all goes dark for him. And maybe that's because the kind of light he's just seen is a hellish light. It's not the light of divine revelation, but the hellish light of burning heat, a burning heat that does not purify or refine, but just throbs in pain. Here's the pain Dante realizes he is about to face within himself as he embarks on this journey deep within. No wonder he passes out. And this vermilion light shines on us, too, as we accompany Dante. Only for us, it's our own underworld we're journeying towards. There ought to be a warning on the cover of the Divine Comedy, "This book will change your life," except that it will change our lives only if we consent to that change. And there, that's the end of Canto 3. The canto began with the inscription on the gate of hell and then brought us to two different groups of inhabitants of this doleful city. The pusillanimi, the nobodies who refused their human gift of making choices, and the recently dead damned souls waiting to take their place further down in the pit of hell. We have crossed the first of several rivers we'll encounter in the Inferno, and as we've just seen, Dante is so overpowered that he faints. Stay tuned for next time when, in Canto 4, we come to the first circle of hell called Limbo, the place of the virtuous pagans. Dante the poet knows how to control the pace, and after the rush of Canto 3, he gives us a moment of calm peacefulness here, where there are no torments, but also no joyful delight, just a steady, gray serenity. Dante here gets to meet Virgil's buddies, the other Greek and Roman poets. And after this, well, then the real hell starts up, but let's not anticipate. There are a few more minutes for us here this evening under lamplight, and I thought a good song to take us out would be Leonard Cohen's Waiting for a Miracle, which in a way is what Dante is doing here too, waiting for the miracle of transformation that will follow his progression through hell. But I wonder if there might be a difference. Leonard is waiting for the miracle to come. Dante sets out on the journey that will bring about the miracle. I wonder, in fact, if this waiting for the miracle to come might even be a song sung by one of the pusillanimi, not taking any steps towards the miracle, just waiting for it to come. He says his hands are tied and he's just up there waiting. And the woman he dreams of, who, like the pusillanimi, is naked, but only partly, and partly is light, well, she too is waiting. and he proposes that the two of them get married, to be together. That couple from the Randy Newman song, two together rather than the crowd just following the flag. The singer here says he's waited half his life away. He is, of course, nel mezzo del cammin, in the middle of the path of his life. Maybe this woman, mostly naked but some of her light, maybe she is his equivalent of Beatrice, bringing the miracle he has been waiting for during that whole first half of his life. Waiting for the Miracle comes from the album The Future from 1992, just about the time when Leonard's voice was really breaking, and I don't mean the adolescent kind of breaking. In fact, the year after the album came out, Leonard won the Canadian Juno Award for the best male vocalist, about which he commented, "Only in Canada could somebody with a voice like mine win Vocalist of the Year." The song was co-written by Sharon Robinson, who worked with Leonard on many of his great songs. But before we get to the song, I just want to thank you for attending to this episode of Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105. And this is Robert Louis Abrahamson wishing you a good night. And now, over to Leonard Cohen, Waiting for the Miracle.
Baby, I've been waiting night and day. I didn't see the time. I waited half my life away. There were lots of invitations. I know you sent me some. But I was waiting for the miracle, for the miracle to come. I know you really love me, but you see my hands were tied. Must have hurt you. It must have hurt your pride to have to stand beneath my window with your bugle and your drum. And me, I'm up there waiting for the miracle, for the miracle to come.
There's nothing left to do.
baby. It was just the other night. Most of you was naked, but some of you was lame. The sands of time are falling from your fingers and your thumb, and you were waiting for the miracle, for the miracle to come. Get married, we've been alone too long. Let's be alone together. Let's see if we're that strong. Yeah, let's do something crazy, something absolutely wrong. You've been taken. Nothing left to do when you're begging for a crown. Nothing left to do when you've got to go on waiting.